Hear that? Believe it or not, summer is just around the corner. Luckily, Armor All, America's most trusted auto appearance brand, has what your car needs to get that perfect summer shine. Plus, now through May 31st, we'll give you $5 for every $20 you spend on Armor All products. That means car wash pods, protectant, tire shine, you name it. Find out how to get your $5 rebate at ArmorAll.com. Armor All. Less work, more clean. Terms apply.
The Athletic.
Hello and welcome to the Race IndyCar podcast. We don't need to do any preamble this week because we've got a podcasting pro alongside us. We've got James Hinchcliffe to join us on the pod. Hello, Hinch. How are you doing?
I'm well, buddy. I don't know if that title works. Just because we've been doing it for a while doesn't mean we've professionals.
Every time I speak to you or we get Alexander Rossi on the pod, it's always the same answer. We're definitely not pros, even though we've been doing it for a long period of time. Also, St. Pete winner. So we'll get onto that a little bit shortly. Also now F1 TV presenter, obviously IndyCar commentator and analyst and IMSA GT driver as well. I guess that's probably the thing that's freshest in your memory is Daytona. I know it didn't go particularly well in terms of the outcome, but did you enjoy the experience anyway?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it's funny, like when I stopped IndyCar at the end of 21, the goal was always kind of to get into IMSA in some capacity, whether it was full time or do some endurance stuff or whatever. And man, you learn real quick that like gone are the days where, you know, JR will know about this, like gone are the days where you could leave an even remotely okay IndyCar career and just decide to go sports car racing one day. And you'd be like choosing between the contracts because you'd be like, yeah, come. Now, like sports car racing, it's so specialized. So many drivers are making that transition at a really young age. And, you know, by the time my old ass shows up, they've been doing it for 10 years. Like, we don't want this guy. Who's this? He was a lot. You drove a GT car last in 2012. Cool story, bro. Get out of here. So like it was tough. It was a tough kind of landscape to navigate. And so, you know, obviously 22 and 23 didn't do anything. And then this opportunity with FAP finally came together for 24. And I was looking forward to it, obviously. But I won't lie, I enjoyed it even more than I thought. Like, I think actually getting back into that environment and getting back proper racing and being with the team and working with everybody, like it was, even though, like you say, the result wasn't what we wanted, the experience was awesome. And I've had some bad Daytona 24s. I left this one in a way better mood than normal because it was just so cool to be back and part of it.
Do you know what your calendar looks like, Hinch, in terms of is it literally just IMSA? Have you got some other opportunities knocking around? What, like for the people who like to follow your career and stuff, let us know what you know about anyway that you can say so far.
Right. Yeah. So, I mean, for me, it's the three endurance races for FAF. So it'll be Sebring next and then Petit at the end of the year. And then if I'm being totally honest, I have agreed to too much other stuff. I don't even know if I have another free weekend to do any more driving this year. So so those will be my two further exploits behind the wheel. Next year, you know, IMSA is changing the rules a little bit. So 6-hour races will require a third driver. So you obviously have the Glen and then now the race in Indy. So if I don't, you know, screw anything up too badly, it might expand that to 5 races next year and kind of go from there, but still have a long year ahead of us to get through.
All right. So before we get into St. Pete, I'm sure anyone who's listening to our podcast will have listened to yours, but give us a little bit of a flavor about your own podcast and where people can find it and kind of what it gets into. Cause it's, I guess you're not really kind of like, It's different to our pod in the sense that we're kind of like breaking down things from an analytical point of view, whereas you guys are kind of talking about it from a driver's perspective with a little bit of like an overview of the series and stuff, which is it's always a cool
for butts.
It's a cool laid back listen.
Me for butts. Yeah, yeah. You guys analyze things in a professional and meticulous and structured way, whereas Alex and I just go on there and talk smack about stuff for the most part. But no, off track with Hinch and Rossi. I think somebody said we've been doing this for 7 years now, which,
oh, geez,
it was almost offensive when somebody said that. I'm like, that cannot be correct. But yeah, it's we talk racing topics certainly and kind of cover it on the broader sense and maybe get a little bit into some of the behind the scenes stuff. And then, yeah, we talk a lot of crap about our daily lives and, you know, it's kind of a funny dynamic. Him obviously still full-time in the series, me mainly being, you know, a TV guy now, and our producer Tim, who I don't even know what he does most days, but he adds a little extra flavor to it. So yeah, Ask Off Track is all of our handles on social, and Off Track with Hinch and Rossi is the name of the show.
I know, obviously you said it was a bit offensive when someone said you've been doing it for 7 years, but I still remember last year when we interviewed Colton Herter and he called JR a member of the media, and JR like was totally offended and was like, what?
It was in a complimentary way.
Yeah.
But I was like very slighted by that.
It's
basically that moniker.
My first hard card that showed up and it says media on it. Like, you're like, all right, that's official now. Like, as I'm legally credentialed as media, so I can't even be offended by that anymore.
Any connection to Jack Benyon is not a good thing, so it would stay clear of being called a member of the media. Anyway, let's get into the IndyCar season, because I'm conscious that we've got a lot to ask you and a lot to get your thoughts on, especially as you've got this kind of unique perspective now as a driver and someone who's been in the series for so long, someone who knows what it takes to win an IndyCar race, be successful at Indianapolis and all of these kind of things. But also now you're kind of forced into a kind of unbiased take on everything through the TV stuff as well. So you've got kind of this unique insight that a lot of people don't really get to have at any point. So I guess a place to start is that JR and I did an episode recently where we picked out five things that we're kind of watching for the IndyCar season. And I don't mean to put you on the spot too heavily, but if we talk about the IndyCar season as a whole, what's the one thing that immediately comes to mind that you're kind of excited about or just interested to see how something plays out, whether it be a driver, a team, or maybe like a wider storyline that you're really interested in for this season?
I mean, I think the big talking point is going to be the hybrids, right? I mean, you've got those, unfortunately, not coming in until mid-season, but I understand why they did that and don't disagree with why it's being put off till, you know, post 500. But that's a big step for the sport. You know, it's going to change a lot of things. I know they're still working on kind of hammering out the details of how it's going to operate, what kind of, you know, control the driver is going to have versus what's going to be automated, things like that. But there's a huge potential for a big shift coming, because one of the ways they could go is to put a lot of, you know, a lot of the control in the driver's hands, which is going to make it's going to be a thinking driver's game even more so than it already is. And IndyCar really is at this point already that. So I think seeing how teams and drivers adapt to that once it comes in is going to be super fascinating. And then for me, there's a lot of new team driver combos that I'm super excited to see how they play out, you know, whether it's Ericsson at Andretti, whether it's Malukas at McLaren, you know, you've got Lundqvist at Ganassi, you've got, no, we don't know at Coin, you got Fittipaldi coming into Rahal. I mean, every team pretty much has somebody new except Penske. So it's going to be interesting to kind of see, you know, how all, first of all, it makes our job up in the booth a lot harder trying to remember who the hell is driving what. I still call the 28. I mean, I'm going to be calling Pelot Hunter Ray. Like it's still sticks in my head that he drives a DHL car, but no, I think it's going to be super exciting for fans.
JR, we're going to get some lightweight Indy cars to start this season without the, obviously the hybrid package isn't going to be used, but a lot of the parts are going to be sort of introduced from the get go. Is that the kind of thing that gets your juices flowing a bit as a driver, knowing that you're turning up to a race weekend with a prospect of breaking lap records and stuff like that? Or does it feel just a bit part of the job when you're kind of rocking up and it's just part of the whole kind of, you just have to get on with it and not really think about that kind of thing too much?
I mean, I think it's something that you think about like when you're not at the track, but then when you get there, it's just, you know, you got to beat the other guys, right? Like yeah. We've talked about this even about, you know, Indy 500 qualifying speeds that, you know, sometimes when you go back and like look at your rings and you look at the speeds on them, you think like, holy shit, like we had a big jump from that year to that year. Like that was actually, it's pretty crazy that we were actually, you know, suddenly just, it seems so commonplace that the cars are over 230 is the average, you know, lap time for so long. That wasn't even like a consideration. But that when you're doing it, you're just like, oh, well, that was still only good for 19th on the pole. You know, so I think that'll very much be how the teams and drivers end up reacting. You're just trying to one up the other guys, and it all will end up unraveling in terms of a qualifying order. And that's all that's going to matter to anybody. But I think the thing, just to speak briefly about it, that Hinch brought up is if we do end up with hybrid coming in halfway through the season, that to his point, particularly if that, you know, that's a monumental task for engineers and teams to adjust to that, like that's going to be an enormous adjustment. You talk about the cars being lighter weight to start the season. That's suddenly all going to go away when that comes, and it's just a completely different package to be dealing with from a setup point of view. But then the same thing, like Hinch said, from a driving perspective, you know, you're not going to have an off season worth of messing around with stuff, you know, to be thinking about it. I think personally, there's going to be a big gap in the teams and drivers that have been doing all of the testing. There's just no way that they're not much more prepared for kind of like the actual in-car use case of the hybrid system. So, you know, there's a lot of things that are, if that occurs, that are just like, you might as well start the season all over again, kind of, when that happens. It's a big shift.
It's such a good point, man, because you know, we can talk about the hybrid and what that's going to bring from like a power standpoint and when you deploy and when you regen and all that stuff. But even if you don't turn it on, throwing that much more weight on the car is going to change it so fundamentally from the driver's seat. Like I remember just putting the aero screen on and the weight that added, how you had to change so much of how you found lap time in the car. And to your point, they're going from cars that were even lighter and faster than last year for the first part of the year. And then now they're going to have these big, heavy beasts that you're going to have to drive totally differently without, you know, 3 months of testing to do it. That is a massive difference behind the wheel.
Have we thought about the idea of, if you think all of the people that have done more testing are going to have an advantage, that we just like give every car a different setup? So some drivers have like a totally automatic hybrid system and some drivers have to do it totally manually and just like rotate it around on a weekly basis just to mess things up and see how it goes, you know?
I think for like a couple of races, drivers should just rotate within all the teams.
I was just going to say like the three Penske guys should go be in the three Ray Hall cars, you know, and like the two Hunkos cars should maybe go into like two of the McLarens and just kind of switch guys around and see who can really handle it.
I guess we should talk about St. Pete. Obviously, Hinch, you won back in 2013, your first IndyCar race. I had a quick look back on YouTube actually yesterday on this because I knew we were going to be interviewing you, and there was a small incident, let's say, between J.R. Hildebrand and Will Power under yellow that kind of took Willie P, who'd been leading the early part of the race, out of the equation. So maybe you should thank JR for
You're welcome,
being part of your first win.
Yeah, I say I don't think I ever bought you a beer for that one. Definitely beer's on me next time I see you, bud. Because that is true. I remember that. Yeah,
Willie P definitely put you in the meat grinder there, JR, watching that back on a replay. Anyway, Hinch, we should ask you about obviously you had a bit of a roller coaster ride up to the IndyCar series, as most drivers do, and then to get that first win at St. Pete. I guess, A, give us a little sort of insight into what you remember about that day and how it felt, but also just, I guess St. Pete generally is just such a special place for you based off of that experience, and you must really enjoy going back there after, you know, remembering all those happy memories.
Yeah, I mean, I think most drivers love St. Pete anyway, you know, like regardless of results. It's just, it's a cool track to drive. It's a cool atmosphere. It's the first race of the season. There's just a lot of things to love about that event. And I always seem to run decently well there. That race, we qualified well. I think we qualified like fourth or something like that. And we kind of ran up at that end of the grid for most of the day. And then that was still back in the good old fashioned double file restart days, mayhem. That was that. I'm sure you loved it as much as I did, JR. It's very, very, very unique way of going racing in an open wheel car. But yeah, we had a late restart. Elio was leading, he was on reds and I was on blacks, and I was starting second, and he just kind of outbraked himself into turn one. I did a bit of an over under on him. And I'll never forget. So we get kind of through 1, 2, 3, going on the back straight there. And I was like, cool, what a jerk making that mistake. Because up to that point, I was running second, which had I finished second, would have been my best career result. So I'm like, I'm happy to have that, to have worked my way up to second. But now if I get to first and then fall back down to second, that second doesn't feel as good as it did three laps ago when I never saw first, you know? So I was actually really pissed at Elliot. And I was just like, you're such a jerk, man. You're in a Penske. You've won this race three times. You're on reds. Like, you're going to go by. And I was so mad at it. I think it like fueled me maybe to drive a little bit. Like, no, screw you, man. You're not taking this away from me. You screwed up. That's on you. I'm going to keep you back there. And that was just kind of, that was my mindset. I was just kind of waiting for him to go by and, you know, just had a clean last 20 laps, whatever it was, and managed to bring it home. But yeah, I mean, it's that what's cool about that moment was, you know, that's validation for that whole roller coaster ride to get to IndyCar that you just talked about. You know, it's so much up and down. It's, I mean, Jared knows the story and I'm sure you guys have talked about it amongst each other and other drivers, whatever, like the path up there can be just so painful for so many people. And, like me, my family certainly went through our fair share over those years, but then in that moment, everything seems worth it. You know, like everything that you miss, everything that you sacrifice, all the whatever it was, the begging, borrowing and stealing money, whatever you had to do to make the season happen, everything, right? It all was totally justified in that moment. And my parents were there and we kind of got to have that moment together. And that was really cool. And yeah, for sure. That still is probably my favorite day behind the wheel of a race car that I've ever had.
Yeah, it's such an incredible, you know, culmination of like you said, just so many unknowns over such a long period of time. You know, the volatility of, you know, the driver's life, I think is something that you don't always even appreciate for yourself while you're going through it. Like, you know, how much just that lack of stability, you know, kind of affects a lot of things that's going on around you. So, you know, having, you know, you and I obviously raced against each other at times, we were of the same generation, certainly coming up that, you know, and I think even for us, like thinking about that period of 2006 to 2009 or something, where we're like, okay, should I be racing Atlantics or Indy Lights or like,
yeah,
what the hell is
Dude,
happening?
That was the
Champ
worst.
Car and like, you know, you're kind of like looking around at all the other guys, like, well, what are they doing? And you know, you're trying to kind of manage like, well, I want to be where it's most competitive, but I also want to be racing for a good team because like both of those things matter. And so I think, you know, I sometimes, you know, look back at just that whole period of time and think for you and I both, like how fortunate we were both to just actually get to the promised land.
Oh, man.
You know, there were so many guys that didn't in the first place. And so then for you to be able to have that even, you know, I was in a good gig that was just, I was just getting paid to show up and drive at that point, whatever we'd say about Panther being a one car team or whatever. You know, you even weren't super solidly there after a really good rookie season and then, you know, getting into the Andretti seat. So I have to imagine for all of those reasons too, just coming from such a tumultuous period in the sport, that had to feel like, okay, like, not that you'd take your eye off the prize, but you see a little bit more of a long-term future start to like open up ahead of you.
Yeah. There's a belonging, right? It's like, I do belong here. I am in the right place. And it's funny, like you talk about that era we grew up in. We grew up, what was your first year racing cars? 04, 05?
Yeah, probably 04. 04 was like Russell. Yeah.
Right. Okay. So you and I are in that same generation of the worst timing to be a racing driver. So 2003, tobacco money stops at the end of there, right? So in 2004, racing doesn't know how to exist in North America. Nobody knows how to find money. And we're even talking the junior category. Like nobody ever knew how to find money back there. But like even in the tobacco days, like players had an Atlantic team, you know, like they had a lights team.
There's at least
team.
Some
like,
trickle down. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So 2004 hits and every Champ Car team is like, where's the money? We don't know how to find money. Yeah. We used to just call up cigarette companies and say like, we need $58 million this year. And they're like, okay. And so that happens. And JNR and I were both on the like the Champ Car side of the war for at least a little bit. Right. And then, well, then 08 happens and now nobody has money, period. Champ Car folds. And you're like, well, hey, I picked the wrong horse. Now I got to start from scratch over here. Like, man, like I made my start in IndyCar. I was 24 years old, and I look at these kids now. 18, like Sage was 18. You know, like these kids are just coming up. Like, yeah, no problem. Like by 24, Colton's won like 8 races. You know, it's like, man, it took a long time to get there. And then, yeah, like you said, I mean, my rookie year, I didn't even do the first race.
That's right.
You know, I did a test for Newman Haas. They're like, great job. Here's a contract. I'm like, sweet. And sign the contract. Like, yeah, we don't have any sponsors yet, but we'll find them because we're Newman Haas. I'm like, yeah, you'll find them. You're Newman Haas. And then we didn't find them. And I literally stood on pit wall in St. Pete and watched Royal go around. And I was like, I guess I'm not going to be a race car driver. I guess I'm done. And then the next race, we had money and we started our season a week late or 2 weeks late, whatever it was. So yeah, all that stuff. And then losing the ride at the end of the year, even though we had a good year because the team folded and then whatever. So yes, even when you get there, like that's just one roller coaster over and then a new one starts. And yeah, it just makes that moment. It makes all those moments special, right? Like as a driver, you go through 100 terrible days for every one good one, but that one good one is what fuels you for the next 100 terrible ones. It's like my golf game.
Yeah, that's totally reasonable. So talking about St. Pete, like I want to ask you about the track. And so, you know, my feeling of it was all like whenever I showed up at St. Pete, it always seemed like that final corner, which is the first corner in every other session. So it's like the corner that you start the hairpin coming onto the front straightaway was always for so many reasons, like the thing that mattered the most, like even if it wasn't for ultimate lap time and qualifying or whatever, like because it's where you start the lap for your qualifying lap. And it's because like you could be, if you're really good or really bad in that one place, it can make or break your race basically. I'm curious if that resonates with you, but then secondarily, like as the track has evolved over the last few years, the cars have a little bit less downforce, all this kind of stuff. It seems like, frankly, that the circuit has gotten tougher just overall, kind of like it's a little trickier. You see guys like just losing it out of nowhere in places that seem, you know, that I like I'm sitting there watching thinking like, I don't know, I certainly trust that these guys are as good or better than anybody that was when I was racing full time. So you have to just kind of like take that for what it is. But we've certainly seen some evolution in terms of where you find lap time, what the danger zones are in the track. I'm curious what your perspective is on that.
Yeah, I mean, I think you nailed all of it. 13-14 is like the bane of my existence. I hate that corner so much. I always have. Because like you say, for lap time, it's not necessarily the most important, but come the race start is there. The restarts are there. The only real passing opportunities at the end of that straight, like if you're not good off of 14, you could be great through the midsection, but like, you're going to get passed and you're not going to be able to make moves. And, you know, if you look at who's usually on pole position, the guy with the fastest sector from turn 4 to turn 9 is often the guy on pole. But that's not where you're going to win the race. And so, yeah, it is kind of a tricky thing to wrap your head around in that sense. But yeah, then to your next point, I think as we started shedding downforce, certain parts of the track did get a bit harder. We're shedding downforce and we're adding weight, right? So when you have a car that doesn't have power steering, every pound is multiplied by 3 pounds if you're going through a 3G corner, or 4 pounds through a 4G brake zone. So every pound higher, like it's a exponential higher amount of effort that it takes to drive it. So you look at turns like turn 3, which, you know, in the body kit days, the manufacturer kit days, was kind of a no-brainer flat out corner once your tires were warm. The chicane 11-12, it was like, yeah, you had to be precise, but like you didn't have to think too much about it. Now, like 11-12, that's like, you have to think about that quite a bit. And like, you are not committing to being flat there for most of the race. You have to make sure you're more set up for the entry to 13. And like, you can really get it wrong there. Turn 3 is like, yeah, I know I've got to be flat, but I really don't want to do it. I don't do this every lap. You know, it did definitely change the way you kind of approach it. And it made what was already one of the most physical races of the year, just because of its length and because of the heat. And because it's the first one of the year, so no one's like race fit yet, right? It just made it that much harder.
11 and 12, I think I remember Scotty Mack having a bit of a moment there, not last year, the year before, going off there. And
yeah, that's right.
Three as well always stands out to me, was where Rossi crashed a few years back as well, when he was like leading on his strategy. Yeah, exactly. And I think what can you say about turn three in terms of what it feels like in the car? Because from the outside, it looks like a relatively kind of normal corner to like an idiot like me who doesn't drive a race car. But I think a lot of that is because, as you said, it hadn't really been an issue for a long time, that corner necessarily, or it was fairly obvious like where it was going to bite you, or, you know, where you needed to be a bit more careful. But now it seems a bit more unpredictable. Is it like the shift of weight in the car, or is it mostly the aero coming off that's been the problem there, do you think? Or
It's a couple of things. Certainly the aero is a big part of it. But what you got to remember about turn three is it's tricky because you're transitioning kind of from the airport roads back onto a city street. So it's a blind corner. You can't see through it. You're coming at it very quick. Like you're just pulling fourth, I think, right before you turn in, sort of thing. And you can't see through it. You got to kind of trust that there's nothing weird on the other side. Because you're transitioning back onto a road, there's kind of a bump there that can unsettle the car a little bit. And because it is such a high speed corner, you know, your tires are working hard. So there's a lot of marbles, a lot of dirt offline, and it's only a one lane piece of racetrack. So if you get it, your timing of turning in, even just a little bit wrong, and you just drop your left sides a couple inches into that dirt, I mean, you're pancaking the left side of the car on the exit. So it looks straightforward, but the consequences are still quite high if something goes wrong. So your concentration level has to be very, very high. And because it's high speed and bumpy, it's also very physical. You know, by lap 90 in a 100 lap race, you're like, get through turn two and you're like, oh, I got to do this again. Okay, hold on. Like taking a breath and like re-gripping on the wheel, like don't let it fall out of your hands, man, because that's going to hurt. You know, it is a tricky one.
Oh, you took me out in the beast last year. Like turn three is the most, well, I feel like anyway, is the most obvious point where you actually feel the car move and you feel the downforce and you feel the ferocity of that corner. And I think another probably element of it is that on TV, it doesn't look like it's that much of a corner. It probably looks much easier on TV than it's one of those corners. Like there's hundreds of them on different tracks all around the world where you just don't get the feeling of what that corner's like until you actually drive through it, I guess. But yeah, JR, I guess the St. Pete's an interesting one because it's changed so much over the past sort of 5 years or so even, that it's hard to kind of draw out any sort of favorite or try to kind of like work out which team or driver is going to be like at the front, apart from, you know, obviously Andretti have had some good cars on street courses in recent years, so you can kind of like think they're probably going to be up there. But then we've seen so much change over the past few years, it's really difficult to kind of like try and predict anything. So I guess going into this, is that how you feel about going into St. Pete, that we don't really know who the kind of contenders are going to be, or are there certain things that you feel like you can kind of just say are definite, that there's going to be certain people or teams quite kind of hanging around there?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I feel like it's a place where you can certainly make a case for a lot of people to be potentially competitive, and that interestingly there's not been a lot of, it's been one of the events for a lot of reasons that like qualifying in the top five doesn't always seem like there's a high conversion rate to like finishing in the top five, kind of, that we don't see that as much. And that's partially, I think, just because it's first race of the season and there's a lot of calamity and, you know, all of these kinds of things. Like it's not necessarily because it's just a race that's like that, but because of that, it makes it, you kind of have to look at both sides of that from the last bunch of years to really draw out like, okay, what were the insinuating circumstances that sort of made it so that cars that appeared to obviously be fast kind of like didn't end up converting? And I think Andretti is the obvious one to point to from that perspective, that they've been really quick more often than not. And you know, you think about last year, Roman like just, you know, it got into the incident with McLaughlin. Neither of those guys end up in the hunt. Both of them, I think you'd look to, it's hard to say where Roman will end up. He's obviously one of the storylines being at Juncos this year. Like, how long does it take for that to, you know, mature enough as a relationship to produce performance? So I'm kind of not hanging my hat on him being the guy that we're looking at in the first event, but you certainly look to the other Andretti cars, you know, as a group of guys, Kirkwood having won two street courses at two street circuits last year, Colton, you know, this is in his wheelhouse. And then Erickson, you know, maybe of a lot of those guys being the one that, you know, we saw Colton just drive the hell out of the thing on Reds for a couple of stints last year and basically be out of the hunt because of that. We sort of know that Marcus is just not that type of driver. So he's sort of the dark horse among the Andretti guys to maybe not be the guy that maybe be the one of the three of them that doesn't make it into the top six, but has just as much sort of capacity over the race to be in the hunt for the win at the end of it as either the other two do. You got to look at McLaughlin and Newgarden, as guys that, and throw Willie P in there. Like he's definitely hasn't lost a step. And, the Ganassi guys are the ones that are always just like the Ganassi and Arrow McLaren, as far as I'm concerned, are just like, I don't know. There's not like some track record at this particular track or this particular style of track that lets you that makes it so that any one of those guys really stands out as like an obvious favorite in those cars. But, they're also the ones that I feel like are doing the most like sneaky development over the offseason to try to write the ship in places that they weren't quite exceptional over the previous season. So, it's just going to be a roll of the dice. And that, as Hinch knows, like the lap time it's so short that it's like half a tenth is going to be a gold mine to be trying to go out there and dig into over the course of the lap. I mean, even when it was back in Indy Lights, it was like the separation between the top three or four was never more than a tenth of a second. And so, ultimately this race has turned into one where it's, whether it's in qualifying or it's in the race, it really does hinge on like not making little errors and just kind of continuously getting the most out of what's available to you at the in the moment.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Hinch, I'm curious how you think the drivers are going to approach this one, because I think there's like a little bit of kind of a couple of things bubbling under the surface here with, obviously last year we had the big crash in turn three at the start of the race where like seven cars were taken out on the, the first lap of the first race of the season, which is like a nightmare for any team getting their season going. But I'm sure you were also speaking to the drivers at content day, and it seems like there's such a mindset shift with the drivers at the moment. All of the ones who haven't won a championship in recent years seem to be talking about the fact that you've got to get off to a good start. And I know that's something that logic dictates, that if you're going to win a championship, you probably should have a strong start to the season. But it's been possible in the past that you can rebound from not having a perfect start to the season. Whereas now it just seems like these guys, like I remember Colton Herta talking about it, a few of the other drivers as well at a content day, just talking about the need for such a strong start to the season. So we've got kind of a juxtaposition of things going on there, where I'm sure people are looking at this race thinking we need to make sure we don't have a massive pile up on the first lap and we need to get through this first race and put points on the board. But also we've got a load of drivers who are really hungry and have identified the fact that they need to have strong starts of the season if they're going to have a chance of winning the championship. So it's quite an interesting proposition for a first race of the season in that sense.
Yeah, it's funny. I think, and JR, I'd be curious what you think about this and if you've had similar thoughts as, You, when you kind of step away from it a little bit, I feel like my opinion on that particular topic has shifted a bit, right? I think I was in the, momentum's important camp and it's hard to come from behind and you get off to a good start and this, that, and the other. When I was a driver, I was very much in that camp. Now in, post-driving days, I look at it a little bit differently, and mainly because Scott Dixon exists. And when you look at like at least three of his championships, he was like 100 points back at half season or whatever. Like he is so good at coming on strong at the end, which is exactly what he did last year. And he won three of the last four races, hadn't won yet, wins three of the last four, solidify second the championship before the last race of the season. And he's just done it so many times. I feel like it's more of a reflection of a team and a driver's ability to like not give up. And I know we say it all the time and we're like, hey, until we're out of it, we're not out of it, blah, blah, blah. But I look at certain situations, certain drivers and teams now, I'm like, you're just saying it because that's what you're supposed to say. I don't believe you when you say it. So I do think there are drivers and teams and atmospheres and environments that need that good start. They need that leg up off the bat, and they can use that momentum and stay confident and whatever. I think there are others whose confidence truly comes from within and their performance comes from within, and they can have two bad races in the first four and they are still very legitimate title contenders. So it's kind of interesting, you know, like Dixon and Ericsson almost had flip seasons last year because Ericsson started really strong. You know, he won that first race. He was going to be on the podium in Long Beach before that mistake. He finishes runner up in the 500, and then it just sort of tapers down where Scott was struggling to find that result. And then once three of the last four, it goes like this. So it's, I really do think it's more driver dependent than anything else.
Yeah. It's really interesting that you say that, because I think that, you know, the more I've reflected on even just my own, you know, career, and you start to think more about, you have time to reflect because you're not just in the middle of it, you know, month to month, day to day, or whatever it is, that, you know, I've certainly realized about, you know, myself and about the way that I approached things at times, that you were in, that I was in a headspace that was kind of, in a way, to simplify it, like you're just in a rush, kind of like that you're trying to, like, you know, you're trying to get to the next thing or get to this level of performance or whatever, because you feel like you need to get there. And that not only is that kind of an anxiety inducing like way of approaching things, but even, you know, even sometimes like when you're in the car, like thinking, all right, I got to go find a 10th, you know, like you start to sort of scramble a little bit to figure out like, where is that even going to come from? Like, where is that? And recognizing that, okay, so even just as a driver in those moments, that being more aligned and kind of connected to like, okay, like I'm just going to go do the thing that I'm here to do and kind of trust myself to do that, given the tools that I've got at my disposal and kind of the preparation that I've done up to today, when I'm going to get out there and get in the car and go do this. I've found it easy to do that at some time in some parts of my career and at certain tracks and certain places, and other times like not so easy. And I think that that general, I look at a lot of kind of the language that you hear from drivers and the you know, the way that they're sort of approaching things like this, like we got to come out of the gates and like get us a win right at the beginning. It's kind of like, okay, well, you're actually now immediately framing this whole thing in a way that like you're dependent on controlling uncontrollable variables to do that.
Correct.
Right.
Exactly.
And so if that's your outlook, that it's just like, I'm jamming a, you know, round peg into a square hole one way or the other here, it makes sense that that backfires as often as it does, you know, and that then that screws up your, if it does backfire, if that doesn't go according to plan, sometimes that's not because you did anything wrong or that you as a group did anything wrong. It's just like your day just didn't pan out the way that you thought it would. And so I think when you talk about Scott and you look at like Ganassi has been just as a group, ultra impressive to me from this perspective over the last couple of years. Like there's been so much kind of, there's been such a shitstorm of like, you know, contractual stuff and all of this kind of madness that's going on. They've got Jimmy there. They've, you know, there's all kinds of like things that you would look at from the outside and say, easy for this to be an enormous distraction. And they managed to just like know themselves and know what they need to focus on and go put one foot in front of the other day after day. And so I guess just to echo your sentiment, particularly about guys like Scott, and I think throw Alex Palou into that mix.
Yeah.
That they just have this kind of natural knowingness about what they can do. And that I think as a, it kind of builds a group out around you in a mindset that like, if we all know that we can show up and do the thing that we're here to do, then you kind of don't get affected by the highs and lows that are out of your control as much. You take some highs that are like, oh man, like we totally lucked out, but you take it like that rather than like, mm-hmm. Oh man, okay, so we won this race, even though it just kind of got dumped into our lap. Like, no, okay, we know we still got to get better to do that again, you know? So it comes, I think, on both sides of it, that I think is, to both of your guys' points, like it's become so competitive, that those little things, those little, the way that you just look at the thing that you're doing, let alone what you actually do when you get out there, matters so much.
I think the never give up thing, Hincha, I wonder if there's also an element of when we get drivers who do have a bit of a lead going into the end portion of the season, let's say that some drivers have a tendency to take big swings at things, and more often than not they miss because they're trying to force things that, like you said, JR, that aren't necessarily in their control, or they're trying to control things that they don't have control of. And I think what we've seen with Dixon is like the playbook of how to try and reel in a championship, because okay, he didn't catch Alex Blow in the end, but he never came out and said we've got to win this week, or like we're going to be out of it if we don't win. He was always of the mind that he was going to do the best that he could possibly do, and he needed Alex Palou to have some trouble and to slip up, but he was okay with that, knowing that he was just going to do the best possible thing in his power. And what actually turned out was that he won three of the last four races, and if Palou had have had a problem, then he would have been in the mix, whereas the other drivers who maybe took big risks, went for wins, didn't pull it off, made mistakes doing it, weren't in the mix at all. And if Palou had have had a problem, then it's kind of like playing the averages, isn't it? Like you're trying to keep everything in your control and I guess make sure you're in the mix at the end. And I feel like that's a little bit of what you were saying there about not giving up. It's also not panicking and trying to do things that are outside of your control.
Yeah, I mean, you know, JR touched on this. Like, you can't control what you can't control. And as soon as you let your mind go to a place where it's affected by an outcome that is outside of your control, you're setting yourself up for failure, right? There's some saying, I'm butchering the wording, but it's like expectation is the father of disappointment. Like, it's, you cannot put, that's why I always try to never put like a numerical goal. Like, we need to finish in X position, or I need to win X number of races. Like, those numbers are irrelevant, and all they do is set you up for failure. And I think, as much as this is kind of a cliche that you hear in sports a lot, especially in racing, I do think it's a little truer, is you have to take it one race at a time, right? So when you do have that big championship lead, don't think about you're just thinking about Friday at Gateway. You're not thinking about Laguna. You're not thinking about St. Pete. You're not thinking about Indy. You're thinking about Friday at Gateway. And if you just kind of live in the day, and I think that's what Dixon does so well, because he doesn't look at, oh, I'm so many points back in the championship. Even if you even say that to yourself on a Wednesday before a race weekend, you're not consciously gonna try less or not try as hard when you get to the week. But somewhere in the back of your head, you've already convinced yourself you're so far behind, what does it matter, right? And I really think he's good at just completely ignoring that. Doesn't look at the point, even though he's so smart, he knows everything that's going on. He in the moment just looks at what he can do today. And when he's on it and that team's on it, what he could do is some pretty incredible things. And he doesn't let that other stuff distract him. And Palou, you know, again, JR, you mentioned him. He's the same way. I look back to his first championship in 21, and back to back, he's leading the championship, has a nice little buffer, but in back to back races, he got taken out, I think, by Rinus or something at Gateway. And then Indy GP, his motor failed running in the top five. And that lead got cut down so much. And over the radio, so this is the thing, you can see the interview and the guy can put on the face or whatever, but like over the radio, as his car is flaming to a stop, he's like, oh, that sucks, get him next week. And like, you could tell it wasn't phoned in. Like, he wasn't just saying that because that's what you're supposed to say because the microphone's in his face. He's like, well, we didn't do that. I didn't do that. It's done. So like, not even thinking about it. I'm over it. Doesn't matter. Unaffected.
Yeah.
And that's why he was able to just pick it back up and still win that championship.
It's definitely going to be fascinating to see how all the other drivers, apart from Alex Palou, approach this season and what they expect to happen. Because I guess no one really expects Palou to be able to go on a run like he did last year. But the fact that he did go on that run last year kind of shows that he could do it again. So we're going to see some drivers scrambling to try and match him. And yeah, it's going to be interesting to see how it all plays out. Hinch, thanks so much for giving us some of your valuable time. Make sure you go and check out Hinch commentating on IndyCar this season on NBC and Peacock, and also Ask Off Track with Hinch and Rossi as well, where you can find him talking about IndyCar and his life generally, and a bit of Alexander Rossi thrown in as well. We've got another treat for you before this episode concludes. We've got Jamie Chadwick on to talk about her Indy Next season coming up with Andretti Global, and also to talk a little bit about a karting program that she has initiated here in the UK. It is UK-centric, but Jamie has asked for help in producing something like this in America as well. So if you're out there and you think you can help Jamie, then why not get in touch? Because this is a great, great initiative that she has set up for this year. So without further ado, we'll head over and speak to Jamie Chadwick. Jamie Chadwick, welcome to the Race IndyCar podcast. I believe this is your first appearance and you've come all the way from Bahrain in Formula One to join us today before you head out to America. So thank you for making the time.
Okay, thank you for having me.
Yeah, it's awesome. It's great to have you on. I guess a good place to start would be to talk a little bit about last year and kind of how 2023 went for you. I know it was a big move that you had to make, you know, transitioning to race in the States, a new series, new car, new tires, a new team, new everything, basically. So I guess looking back on it now, kind of how do you feel the year went from your perspective? Obviously, don't want to get too much into like race by race, but your kind of general feelings about how it went.
Yeah, don't worry, I'm not going to go into every second from the whole season. But yeah, honestly, I think by the end of it, I felt quite happy with the progress and how the kind of season went as a whole. I think definitely not where I wanted to be at the start of the year. A huge kind of learning curve in that sense. Lots of new things, like you said. First race was for sure a baptism of fire, but honestly, I really, really enjoyed the season. Results aside, enjoyed the season a lot. Loved working with the Andretti team. Loved being in the Indy Next Championship. The tracks, the racing, everything that, you know, I was able to experience in that first year was amazing. Of course, yeah, we wanted to have a bit more success on track. And I think that's the big reason for this second year push to come back and to try and achieve that. But yeah, I think everything I learned in the first year is going to give me a good foundation for this second season. And there's a lot of new things, but I think definitely times where I took a while to adapt, and now going into the second year, just feel like full focus on what the job is in hand.
There's so many things to adapt to, and I guess like there's all the obvious things like the new car, the tyre, I guess, is so much different to anything that you really get to race on in Europe. Also, I guess the racing on oval for the first time, all of the different types of tracks and style of racing. But I guess the one that kind of interests me quite a lot is when you get drivers who have grown up in Europe coming over and they kind of get to feel the different style of racing, like how the teams operate. And I never like to say that it's more laid back, because I think that has like a negative implication that the teams don't work as hard, but it is a different atmosphere. And it's certainly one where I feel like people are able to maybe enjoy going racing a little bit more than perhaps they do in Europe. And I guess there's maybe like a little bit of pressure attached to that when you go racing in Europe that maybe isn't quite there as much in America, or you're kind of given a little bit more kind of leeway. Is that something you found and something you kind of felt?
I agree. It's really hard to kind of word it. I was asked a lot last year, you know, the differences between racing between the two, between the States and Europe. And it was hard to kind of say it in a way that didn't disrespect racing in America whilst also disrespecting, you know, the environment in Europe. I think they're just very different. And I think what you learn in Europe is incredible. The conditioning that young drivers have in Europe, you look at most of them that go over to the States after years in F3 and F2 and almost always have a degree of success over in America. And I think that is for a reason. You are well conditioned and you learn a huge amount. But at the same time, there is something about the culture in America where, you know, everyone's just there because they love the sport, and slightly less potentially cynical towards, you know, your level of success or not. They just are happy to see you racing and given the opportunity. And I do enjoy that. You know, I'd have a bad day, and really, I think as a racing driver, if you have a bad day, no one needs to tell you again that you've had a bad day. So the fact that you've got fans and support and people that are sort of giving you a pat on the back and saying, don't worry, we'll go again tomorrow kind of attitude, rather than, yeah, really feeling like you're having an even worse time of things. Definitely an environment that I felt like gave me, a lot of sort of, or made me really enjoy being over in the States last year. And like I said, it's a big reason that I want to come back and push for more this year.
I feel like your driver already has, you know, a lot of like people applying pressure from the outside and stuff like that. But I know you're basically the hardest person on yourself, and you really look introspectively at things and you're really pushing your own performance. So I guess where are you looking at for your gains to come from in 2024? Where are the obvious, you know, kind of places that you want to improve and the things that are going to kind of take you to the next level in Indy Next?
Yeah, I think being really specific about it. Qualifying was definitely took my weakness last year. I think I wasn't surprised that I sort of was a bit slower to get up to speed, learning a lot of the tracks and things on the Friday in practice. But then sometimes I wouldn't necessarily make the sort of improvements that I felt like I needed to come qualifying. So qualifying for sure is a big focus. I think the races definitely are a different kind of animal, but I think we learned a lot in a lot of the races, and the fact that we were, I think we didn't not print or we only didn't finish one race. So in that sense, we did a lot of laps last year in the races. I learned a lot there. So those I feel like come to me a little bit, but sure, the qualifying element and then, yeah, the aggressive nature of the races is a focus for this year.
Certainly looks like from the outside that there's not a whole lot changing with the series. So I guess that's kind of a positive to come back to something that looks fairly similar to what you left. I guess just going into Indy Next for a second season, what does that look like in terms of how like accurately you're able to predict, you know, where your gains might come from and how things might look? Because yeah, I guess it's always difficult year on year to kind of say, we've made improvements in this area as a driver, then it depends a lot on what the team have done as well. And it's a whole package, isn't it? So I guess for people who are, you know, obviously watching your progress closely and want to see how you're going to get on in 2024, what does that look like at the moment? What can you say in terms of what you're expecting?
It's a good question. I think every driver under the sun in the off season says, oh, I want to win races. I want to be on the podium. I want to win the championship in the off season, and say that about the first race until you get to the first race. I don't think you really know exactly where you're going to place up. I know we've made a lot of improvements into my internal team and within Andretti. We've made a lot of steps over the winter to kind of improve things, but for all I know, everyone else could have done the same. And, yeah, you know, it is how it is. So we're very focused on ourselves. I think my focus this year is to be in a position where I don't want to... Last year, I got a few results where I kind of floated around the pack and there were incidences in front of me and sort of would end up in the top 10, top six as a result. I don't want to have a season like that. I want to be able to competitively race for podiums and ultimately race for victories at times. So that's kind of my focus, having that kind of intent and ability to be up there. In pre-season testing, the team seemed really strong. So they seem to think they've not changed a huge amount, but I'm hoping, they've made steps on their sides. And like I said, we've made a lot of progress on our side. So I'm looking forward to it.
Was there any area in terms of like road courses, street courses, ovals that you kind of looked at in the off season to focus on? Or is it just kind of like all of the above and you can't really single anything out?
No, I think the oval's definitely something to work on, because the ovals for me was something that until I did at least a race or two races, you don't really know what you don't know yet. So there's a lot more opportunity to kind of focus on those in the off season rather than last year it was an unknown until we even drove an oval. So it's a bit more focus around that, especially now we've got Nashville adding another oval, given four ovals on the season. It's quite a big part of the championship, so that has been a focus. Road courses and street courses, there's not really anything new on this year's calendar, which is good for us. I think, like I said, learning a lot from last year, can be a lot more specific with the approach, which is good.
I guess with the ovals, not only is it like a new thing, but you can also, there's like such thing as doing too much work, isn't there? Like you can do too much analysis and work yourself up too much in terms of like trying to prepare as well. So that must be quite a difficult balance for someone who's coming from, you know, not doing that before, to then know how much you should be learning and how much you should be analysing things and how much you should just say, actually, I'm not going to look at this piece of data because I don't really understand it, or it's not something that's going to help me improve in this kind of scenario.
I'm sure there is, but then at the same time, like even, you know, being in Bahrain at the weekend, spending time seeing sort of within the Williams team, for example, seeing how Formula One drivers operate, I think there is such thing as too much information, but there's also, you have to be able to absorb as much information as possible. And what I'm looking forward to or hoping for this season is having a little bit more capacity in the second year to have a little bit more information to take in, I think, because there's so much that was new in the first year. I was almost a bit overloaded with all the new stuff. So there's hopefully a bit more of an opportunity to take more info in.
It's a horrible question to ask given that we've not even started the 2024 season yet, but what does 2024 mean for you in terms of your kind of career? And just give the listeners a bit of an idea of what the, I guess I don't know if you have like a 2-year plan, a 5-year plan, a 10-year plan, but I guess obviously you've made this big change to come over and race in America, but it's not the only place you can race, and there's, you know, there's lots of options for you, like, kind of available for the future. So what are you kind of working towards at the moment, and kind of how crucial is 24 for that?
It's really crucial. I think we always looked at Indian X being a 2-year program. Even from the outset, it was always the plan to try and do 2 years of Indian X to learn as much as we can. So kind of going into the second year, kind of the plan after that rides a lot on the success of this year. And I think a really, really great year. Of course, I want to be in IndyCar. And it's nice knowing that there's an opportunity there if, you know, you have success in Indy Next. That's kind of the way that the system has allowed young drivers to progress. But then also, yeah, beyond that, there's so many opportunities and drives that I'd love to explore if the opportunities present themselves. Daytona, IMSA. A lot of it's over in the States at the moment, but I'd love to have the opportunity to do that. So really the full focus on this year is performance and just, yeah, having as good of a year as possible to kind of be in a position to keep progressing in the sport.
For sure. And you've had a busy off season because you've been doing all sorts of stuff still. But I guess the one thing I wanted to pick you up on was the karting program that you've launched here in the UK. It's just such a cool grassroots program. Maybe you could talk us through a little bit. And I know it's kind of UK centric for our US listeners, but I still think it's like something that could and can be like transferred potentially in the future and can apply to different countries as well. So why don't you give us a little bit of an outline of what you're doing there and what that means?
Definitely. And on that, I'd love to do something in the States as well, for sure. And yeah, basically it's kind of looking at what can we do to kind of hit real grassroots level of the sport. And you know, there's so many initiatives and so much going on now to encourage more women in the sport, which I think is fantastic, but still lacking that like real grassroots, just started having never started in the sport at all. And when I first began in the sport, it was kind of rental karting that, you know, first attracted me to it. And without an older brother, I would never known that there was an opportunity to do it. So this is really trying to kind of encourage as many young girls or any women actually to give it a go, experience it for the first time. Like I said, you might hate it, you might love it, but that's not the point. It's just giving it a go and having that opportunity. So the initiative, there's two parts of the initiative. One is that all women will go for free on International Women's Day, which is March 8th, which is actually quite soon. And the other bit is there's the Jamie Chadwick series, which is a series of events, and the winner will get a bit of funding and mentorship from me, but I'll also mentor those at the events as well. So yeah, like I said, it's aimed at young girls, but also it's about creating a community. I don't think being so elitist to kind of just put the sport at, you know, that should be available to people that want to make careers in it. It should be available to everyone, and everyone should have the opportunity to enjoy go-karting and have that opportunity.
Yeah, the careers point's an interesting one. I guess I've felt like over the past sort of 5 years or so, there's been a lot of things popping up, like W Series. Obviously, you've had a lot of success in that, and those kind of things are great, but they're really high up on the ladder, and they're obviously helping even people like you, you know, take the next step in your career and help you to progress. But lower down, there needs to be kind of more going on down there. So I guess, was that something that you kind of had a thought about and set out to go on? Like, how did the karting program come about?
It's exactly that. It's kind of looking at people that, you know, might not necessarily see it as a career or even know that's an opportunity, just giving them the chance to give it a go. And, you know, there's such a small talent pool in motorsport. There's so few people that get to try it, that if we can just grow that and expand that, I think it will be great across the board in the sport. And I think so many people have the opportunity, or pretty much everyone has an opportunity to kick a football, but not many people have a chance to drive a go-kart. So like I said, it's not necessarily about every single one of those wanting to have a career in the sport, but if they can word of mouth, tell their friends, encourage as many people, they go with their friends, their family, to get involved, then the chance of us finding more female talent to progress through the ranks is greater.
We had Angela Ashmore on the last episode of the podcast. The Chip Ganassi Racing engineer is working with Marcus Armstrong this year, and we were talking about a similar subject, I guess, and kind of her feeling on, you know, being a female participating in motorsport, and basically just like kind of the fact that we want to talk about her being an engineer for Marcus Armstrong and not being a female engineer or the first female or the, you know, the fourth female engineer that's been a lead engineer in IndyCar. And I guess I'd be interested to get your thoughts on how you feel about that as well, because I guess when you finish a race, you just want to be you know, the first Jamie Chadwick to finish a race, right? You know, it doesn't matter what gender you are or anything like that. It's just obviously wanting to excel. But then at the same time, you feel like you've got a responsibility to give back to, you know, young women who don't necessarily have the role models in place to get them into the sport in the first place. It's kind of a difficult thing to balance, I guess.
It's exactly that. It's just that balance. Yeah, of course, for all of us that are in the sport, we're not in the sport because, you know, we wanted to be the first females to do anything or anything like that. We just want to be in the sport because it's a sport that we love and enjoy and want to have success in. So there's that side of it. But at the same time, you know, if one young girl watches the TV and sees Ashley, for example, as a lead engineer, and there is attention on her because she is a female engineer and that is unique, but that encourages her to get into it, then I think that is also something that I think we can't overlook. So there's two sides of it. I think I'm sure a lot of people think there's a lot of forced things that we're doing in the sport to try and encourage as many female drivers and, well, not just drivers, but, you know, female participation within the sport. But at the same time, I think it does need to happen a bit like that to really make the difference initially.
I guess just going back to St. Pete before I let you go, I guess the thing that always jumps out for drivers who usually come from Europe, it's usually like the first race of the season. So it's one of the first chances you get to do like a proper bumpy American street circuit. Give us a little flavor of what your feelings were the first time you went there and maybe just a general taste of American street racing, because it's quite a bit different to what you usually kind of get in Europe and the rest of the world, really, I guess.
There were a few things that stood out. Honestly, the track itself is one of the smoother.
Yeah, it's not that bad, is it? Yeah, it's probably a bad example.
So we tested at Sebring and things, and it was still bumpy relative to some of the tracks I'd driven, but that didn't seem too bad. The main thing that stood out for me was, it was very close. It's quite a short track. So, you know, I think I was within 8 tenths or something, but I was pretty much off the back in my first race. So it was super close, super tight because it's such a short lap. But the main thing that stood out in the race is, I mean, I got caught up in a tangle in the early laps and went a lap down. And just the pace is 100% every lap. It's a 4 to 5 lap race and there is no saving anything, no conservation, no management. It's just pushing every single lap. And as a result, it's absolute carnage. So in Europe, if you get involved in an incident and you take assistance from the marshals, you're out of the race. In this, you just get pushed back and you go again. So I got pushed back, I went again, got a new front wing, and yeah, I was a lap down and I still think I managed to finish 13th or something. I was more than a lap down actually. And it's just because it's chaos, it's carnage. It's 100% every lap, everyone's racing as hard as they can every lap. And because of that, it's so exciting. And yeah, definitely I was pretty shocked by the nature of that by the end of the race.
Well, best of luck with the season. I know you've got a lot of traveling ahead before you actually get there. It probably feels like it's a long time away, but it's actually only a few days. So best of luck with the season. Hopefully we can get you on a little bit later on in the season. You can let us know how your season's going. But thanks, Jamie Chadwick, for joining us on the Race IndyCar podcast.
Cheers. Thanks, Jack.
That was Jamie Chadwick. Great to get her on and hear about her Indy next season coming up and also about that karting program as well. So you can check out more information about that on her social media. We're running out of time here, but I do want to get through some news stories that we probably haven't covered off in recent weeks on the Race IndyCar podcast. Do make sure you go back and check out our back catalogue of episodes. We've got loads of interviews, loads of pre-season bits and bobs. We picked out 5 things to watch for the 2024 season a bit earlier in the year. Most recently, we had Angela Ashmore, who is the 4th lead engineer, female lead engineer in IndyCar history. Chip Ganassi racing with Marcus Armstrong, and she joined us to talk about that opportunity she's got there. So definitely go back and check out that episode. Speaking of St. Pete, we've had the confirmation that Callum Ilott will step in for the injured David Malukas in the number 6 car at Arrow McLaren. So that was a long-running expectation that Callum would take that car. He was the only driver that tested the car for McLaren, so he was definitely expected to take up that seat for St. Petersburg. So top 5 there last year with Funcos. He'll be looking forward to the opportunity to drive one of the series' best cars, really, and one that should have won the race last year if Pato O'Ward hadn't had a plenum fire late on and handed that victory to Marcus Ericsson. Speaking of Pato O'Ward, he's got a brand new contract that sees him through 2027. We know this because of some Alex Palou court papers that emerged in the court case between McLaren and Palou. You can check out more about these court papers in a feature on the-race.com where we broke down what we've learned from these new papers that came out very, very recently in February, and a little bit about the implications of what they might mean as well. You can go and check those out. Sticking with St. Pete, we also now finally have a Dale Coyne Racing driver lineup. So we've got Jack Harvey and Colin Braun in for that race. So Jack Harvey, formerly of Ray Hall, Letterman, Lanigan and Meyer Shank Racing. He won't need any introduction to anyone. Colin Braun, maybe so for IndyCar fans, as he's more from the sports car side of things. Tried to forge a NASCAR career in the late 2000s and has been a ever-present force in sports cars. I think 2023 was a big breakthrough year for him in the IMSA paddock, where he was racing for Meyer Shank with Tom Blomqvist and really, I think, surprising people with his pace and performance. And yeah, he's a quick learner and someone who doesn't lack commitment. So he'll be an interesting driver to watch in IndyCar. So Braun's in the 51 car, Harvey in the 18, and Harvey will do 14 races in that car and share the rest with Indy Next driver Nolan Siegel. He was the rookie of the year in Indy Next last year in the same series that Jamie Chadwick is racing in. He will drive the Indy 500 and the $1 million thermal race, the non-championship race that takes place next month. So Siegel getting two definitely very big opportunities. He'll also race in Indy Next, so he's dovetailing these programs, and the IndyCar races he'll do don't clash with his Indy Next program that he's trying to win. I don't think we got the chance to tell you about Nashville shifting its season finale from a street circuit to an oval either. It's now at Nashville Super Speedway. You can read more about that on the race as well. And another kind of little behind the scenes move that maybe hasn't got the level of attention that some might expect. Craig Hampson has left Arrow McLaren, the engineer, and he's returned to Andretti, where he's had Indy 500 winning success in the past. One of the most sort of sought after engineers and well respected engineers in the IndyCar paddock. So he's heading to Andretti to oversee their engineering efforts on their three cars there. So plenty of news ahead of St. Petersburg. We also had a briefing with Mark Miles, Penske Entertainment president, and we've had some information come out from IndyCar as well, all kind of rule-related and related to the future of IndyCar with Mark Miles as well. So plenty of stories there, including the prospect of a new engine and new chassis for 2027. That's not set in stone, but something that's been discussed, and you can read more about that in a feature coming up on the race. Also, basically a confirmation that the hybrid will come in for the second part of the season. That was always the plan from people on the inside from IndyCar, but there was also the possibility that they might delay and start in 2025 instead. But we're definitely going to see that hybrid racing in the second half of 2024, unless something goes majorly wrong there. A very successful recent test with a lot of mileage covered has given them a lot of positivity there. So hopefully the tide turning on that story, where it's been negative news for a long time, but bringing that in the second half of the year, they'll be happy with that, bringing that in, and also definitely talking about the next level of IndyCar rules as well. So you'll be able to read more about that on the-race.com. We'll be back with another episode of the Race IndyCar podcast straight after St. Pete to break down all of the action that happened over the first weekend, where we'll get into some more of the nitty-gritty of that St. Pete weekend. And that's all for this episode of the Race IndyCar podcast.
The Athletic.